Well, welcome to the Martin School. And this is one of my favourite buildings in Oxford. I love the elephant in the spotlight at night. If you haven't seen it before, you'll see the elephant lit from the body when you come out because of the history of the Indian Institute. Well, there are not many superstars in decision-making, but one of them is here tonight, Gert Gigerenzer. And I just looked at my bookshelf, and so let's just think a little bit about bounded rationality. This idea that that we're all rational human beings, well, to a degree. This is Gert's book on bounded rationality. And the concept of adaptive thinking. And then for the public, risk savvy. How do people make decisions? And this has been areas which, when we started evidence-based medicine, I don't think I'd heard of Gert Gigerenzer, which is a great pity. But over the years, we've seen how the idea of logic and teaching people things called facts and using things called numbers only goes so far, because rationality only goes so far, as Gert will be describing. And I once said to Dave Sackett, how do you judge a library? How do you evaluate a library? He said, it's the number of books being stolen. This is a book Gert and I edited called Better Doctors, Better Patients, Better Decisions. And I've only got a German edition left. And really, Gert has helped us think dramatically differently about the way decisions are made. When we launched this book, I looked round, and there, sitting about there, was the governor of the Bank of England, because he'd read and been influenced by Gert. And I wonder, why the hell is he here? Because we have been doctors making decisions and patients making decisions. But of course, Gert had shown that, supposing you were a young, bright young hedge fund manager, what sort of decision maker were you? Were you a gambler, or how do you use heuristics? Well, no one had ever thought of that before. So the Bank of England and the big money people, also recognized what Gert had to offer. And that's what led to the center in Cambridge with David Spiegelhalter and Gert's own work, which has spanned a number of countries, including Chicago. And he's now based back in Berlin. But we're very privileged to have you here, Gert. We've learned a great deal from you. You're working full blast, I know. And the job's not done yet, so I'm very glad you're still working. So, ladies and gentlemen, Gert Gigerenzer.
Thank you, Muir, for giving us the insight in your private library. Portable private library. In the 19th century, the health of the public increased substantially by clean water, better hygiene, and healthy food, and enough of it. That is called the first revolution in healthcare. In the 20th century, we had the professionalization of medicine and great scientific breakthroughs. And clinics, it was the century of the clinics and the doctors. What the 20th century has not had in its vision is patients that would understand and could make informed decisions. Today, in the 21st century, we are waiting for the third revolution in healthcare after the 20th century, a revolution that Muir and I called the century of the patient. That medicine makes a turn towards having as its primary goal the patient, not all the other things. Yet in modern high-tech healthcare, Patients appear to be the stumbling block, an uninformed, anxious, non-compliant folk with unhealthy lifestyles who demand treatments advertised by celebrities, insist on unnecessary but expensive imaging, and may eventually turn into plaintiffs. The one solution proposed is new paternalism, namely, nudge the patients where you want that they end up. I don't think we need more paternalism in the 21st century. We had enough in the past. There is a different vision, namely patients who are risk literate, who know where to find information that's reliable, and you can make informed decisions based on their own values. Muir Gray and I got together in 2009 on a workshop where we collected 40 people from medicine, psychology, computer science, and statistics in order to discuss the possibility for such a third revolution. The outcome of that meeting is a book with the title Better Doctors, Better Patients, Better Decisions, Envisioning Healthcare 2020. Now, that's now. Looking back, we might have written Better Envisioning Healthcare 2120. But Muir and I are a little bit on the optimistic side and impatient and wants to get things done. And we also believed that then, 2009, the financial crisis would actually help to get this project done. Because if there's less money, then the medical profession has time to think about the true virtue and the true goal, the patient. Now, in this workshop, we analyzed seven problems in healthcare that we believe need to be solved in order to get towards the century of the patient. And that are the seven problems. It's a simple calculation. You add them up and you get misinformed patients. You don't even need all of them. And what I'm going to do today is to go quickly through some of them and spend most of the time on the last one. And to give you the key essence is, the good news is that our book is as timely and relevant as a decade ago. That's also the bad news. There is one thing I should add that we hadn't envisioned so 10 years ago. That is the impact of digital technology on health and the push of IT companies into health. We had somehow naively believed that digitalization would help our cause. It would provide access for everyone to all the information relevant. Yet that hasn't happened. Just to illustrate, digital health records are a great idea, but they will not be able to unfold their potential in current health systems. They're not falling on fertile ground. So one example, in the US, in 2005, calculations by the RAND corporations were that by having electronic health records, one could save $81 billion every year. So for instance, avoiding duplicate tests, having the information available, and all the errors that come in. In 2013, they reviewed the situation and found that costs had not decreased. They had steeply increased. What had happened? The industry, the software industry, had gamed the electronic health records. They were made in the first place for billing, not for serving the patient. And for instance, recommender systems were built in that would recommend the doctor. Maybe you should do that test. Huh? Maybe a CT, maybe something else. And doctors sometimes surrender to that just to be on the safe side. And that was how the entire system was gamed. Or there is another example is much funding has been invested, also something we did not foresee, into big data analytics in health. You may remember IBM's Watson interacting with Bob Dylan, Serena Williams, and other celebrities, lots of marketing. But does all of that help patients? A systematic review last year of 58 articles on big data applications in genomics, drug discovery, personalized healthcare, precision medicine, mental health, oncology, and so on, concluded that there is no evidence of its practical benefits in healthcare. My personal conclusion on that new topic is the benefits of digitalization can be reaped only if the existing problems, the seven sins, are resolved first. Otherwise, digital health will become a band-aid solution. So, how does our list fare today? So I will now go through some of these points, and as I said, spend most of the time to the last one. Every one of these points in the book has a number of recommendations. I will cannot report all of that. I cannot go into anything. I cannot present a systematic review of every of these points. You can do that. You can write seven systematic reviews on each of these points, how it's now. But I will start with an example that is on the first point and illustrates the key problem. I use a very common example, namely breast cancer screening with mammography. So in many countries, health institutions and doctors ask, how can we get more women into screening? Many countries set a certain goal, like 80% in the UK. No? How would you do that? There are basically a number of options. One is strong paternalism. The president of Uruguay has installed mandatory breast cancer screening for all women who are in public service. That's a simple solution. It is not one that makes people risk literate. Or in Western countries, we have many attempts to nudge people into behavior, so to nudge women into by sending them a letter with a certain date or by giving them misleading information. That's also. This is not our vision. Why not do something and inform women about the benefits and the harms of breast cancer screening so that every woman can make her own decision. That can be easily done. Here is a fact box. The fact box is from the Harding Center for Risk Literacy, which I direct. It is called Harding Center because it has been funded since 12 years by a London investment banker, David Harding. Thanks to his, he read one of my books called Reckoning with Risk. And as an investment banker, he knew that most other investment bankers and financial experts don't understand numbers. But he wasn't aware that doctors also are innumerate, and churches and lawyers too. So he thought, oh, that's a case where I spent my money. And by the way, in Cambridge, your partner in your university, there is the Winton Center for Risk Literacy and Evidence Communication, which is our sister institute. We are the only ones. And so a fact box takes all the available evidence in that case about randomized studies with about 500,000 women, but reports everything in simple, understandable numbers. No odds ratios, no relative risk or other misleading statistics. So how to read that? So think about 1,000 women who participate in screening, 1,000 women who don't. They're all over 50. The question is, what happens 10 years later? And benefits, breast cancer mortality, 5 out of 1,000 died from breast cancer, and in the screening group, it's 4. Clear? Then total cancer mortality is even more important because you don't know always from which cancer a person died if she had multiple cancers. And it's 21 in each group. That tells you there's no life saved from mammography screening. But one woman less dies in the screening group, but one woman more dies in the screening group for another cancer. And then there are harms. So women who do not have cancer, they're false positive, the test isn't good, and an estimated 50 to 200 are harmed. You will see here the harm numbers are all intervals. What's the reason? The focus of most medical research is on the benefits. Harms are not so taken so seriously, so we have no very precise estimates. And the second harm is for women who do have cancer, but a cancer that's non-progressive, that is, they would never notice of that thing that happened to their cells in their lifetimes, and it shouldn't be called cancer. But it's detected, and they get unnecessary lumpectomy, mastectomy, and or other kinds of treatments. So that's a fact box. That's the way one could transparently do. And you can see many fact boxes under our website. And so you have an easy way to look into what evidence-based medicine knows today, and they are being updated. So. Now, let's go back to the question. How can we get women into, how can we get more women into screening? This is not the proper question from my point of view. The proper question is how can we inform women? And and that's a way to do it. So if you would push women into screening, what would you do? You would not report about total cancer mortality, and that's find me a single health brochure where this fact is being reported. And how would you report the 1 in 1,000 difference in breast cancer mortality? So you might not say it's 0.1%, but you might say there is a 20% reduction because it's a relative risk. It sounds better, isn't it? And 20% reduction is often rounded up to 30% or more. Here, the Welsh NHS leaflet breast cancer screening says breast screening has been shown to reduce the risk of dying from breast cancer by around 35%. No absolute numbers are given. That's a reduction from 5 to 4. Round it up. Or New Zealand comes up with 33%. The change is here to the NHS leaflet for England. So no longer relative risk, but now it's absolute risk, how it should be. But look at the number. It's not 1 out of 1,000, it's 1 out of 200. In Germany, we had this same situation. So first, long ago, women were just told what to do. Then one gave them number, but misleading numbers, like 35%. Then we protested over years. And then finally, absolute numbers were given, but also 1 out of 200, not 1 out of 1,000. I know the situation in Germany very well, and it's probably similar here. There was one fraction who wanted to increase participation rates, and they were against reporting absolute numbers. And there was another fraction who said, we can't go on in the 21st century and misleading women. We should be honest. And the agreement was, yes, we report absolute numbers, but higher numbers. In Germany, we have now gone beyond this phase, and the proper numbers, like 1 to 2 in thousands or so, are in the brochures. Just an example. So what is the consequence of the misleading brochures on the thinking of women? What's the benefits of breast cancer screening with mammograms? We have done the first European-wide study with 1,000 British women and asked them, so exactly the question, so if 1,000 women go, 1,000 women don't go, what happens 10 years later? How many of you die from breast cancer? And the the best answer is 1 out of 1,000. And these are German women here, what you see, and less than 1% is aware of that. Most are overestimated highly or have no idea. Are British women better informed? What do you think? Yes? No? Here? Yes, it's more than 100% more. In reality, you have a huge peak here in the UK, and that's 20%. We had 9 countries. Here's a question on your intuition about health systems, how they influence their the citizens. There was one country out of 9 who stood up in the sense that there were much more people, many more people, who had an estimate in the correct area. Which country is that? I'll give you the countries. So it's not Germany. You can't be worse. It's not the UK. The other countries were all the big countries in Europe. France, Italy, Spain. The Netherlands, Austria, Poland, and the European part of Russia. There's one country where there are definitely more correct answers than in all of the others. What do you think?
Netherlands?
Netherlands is everyone's guess who is informed about the health system, because they have a very good health system, but no, in terms of screening, their population is equally misled. Do you have another case? Russia, right. Here, you see? And it holds both for women and for men. So the realistic estimates, everything unrealistic is an order of magnitude or 2 orders of magnitude too high. Yeah? The reason is not that Russians get more information about screening than all the rest of Europe. The reason is probably they get less information and less misleading information. On this issue about the bias reporting in health pamphlets, there is a positive news. In Germany, we have succeeded to have in the national cancer plan a clear statement that, and Germany is moving now away from, I read, the goal of informed participatory decision-making is now ranked higher than the goal of a maximum participation rate in cancer screening. That's a very clear and honest statement which says before we were not, our primary goal was not to inform women. Now it is. That's a brave statement, and it's still difficult to push it through against all the interests and also against the emotions of many patients who feel that some, particularly in the US, many women feel cancer screening is a moral obligation. If you don't do it, your friends will not no longer talk to you. They're brainwashed. And it takes also courage to take over responsibility about your own health yourself. But medical science gives you a good key to make correct decisions. And sometimes, if you understand the health system, then you understand you need to think yourself. Because you are in health systems that are more or less, depending on the country, profit-driven and not in your interest. So, let's go on. I'll go quickly. Biased reporting in the media, compared to the first point, in my opinion, not much has changed. And we have a new problem, the social media, which increases the variance totally of the reports. Biased reporting in medical journals. I did a check for this talk, and here are two of the recommendations that Mu and I gave. So every of these points has a number of recommendations. The first one was journal editors should clearly announce that evidence framed in relative risk without baselines, mismatch framing, 5-year survival rates for screening, and other non-transparent formats will no longer be published. I will explain these formats in a minute. And also, institutions that subscribe to medical journals should give journals publishers 2 years to implement the previous action, and if publishers do not comply, cancel their subscription. We thought it's a brilliant idea, but not much has happened. And I'll show you here just an example. Before Better Doctors, there was an article that had analyzed 119 systematic reviews in the BMJ, the British Medical Journal, in JAMA, in the Lancet, between 2004 and 2006. Absolute risks that are easy to understand were reported in only 50% of the reviews, or similar numbers like number needed to treat. Mismatch framing is the idea that you report numbers for benefits and harms, but you report absolute risk for the one and relatives for the other one. Guess how? How would you do that? How would you report the benefits in relative or in absolute numbers? In relative, because they're bigger, yeah? And how do you report in the same articles the harms? In absolute numbers, huh? Because they're smaller. That was the case in 30% of the articles. That means misleading statistics starts not with journalists. It starts already in the top medical journals, and of course, in press releases. Has that changed after Better Doctors? I found two large studies. One was about 202 systematic reviews, including about half of them Cochrane reviews, the best evidence basis we have. Absolute risks were reported in only 36 of these reviews for the most relevant patient outcome. So there's no improvement here. And another study looked at 55 guideline recommendations and absolute risk for benefits and harms reported in 31%. I cannot detect here that anything has improved. And it's very clear why it's being done. Yeah, because in these days, journals and journal editors think about how they are represented in the media, including the social media. And if you have a news that you have a drug that reduces heart attack by 50%, that has a chance to go and fly. But if you say, it reduces mortality from heart attack from 2 in 100 to 1 in 100, that means 1 percentage point doesn't fly. And people are still innumerate to fall into this trap. The Enlightenment is far away. So back, biased funding of research is the problem, that research being funded that's in the interest of the industry, but not in the interest of the patient. Typical example, Me Too drugs. The drug already exists, but the company wants to have another one to sell it. That's of little help to patients. One of our recommendations was that research should be funded. That helps to understand the causes of lack of risk literacy among doctors, healthcare providers, and patients. That has also not happened. A great example is, do you know healthnewsreviews.org? Healthnewsreviews.org, Gary Schwitzer, a website that exists since more than 10 years, which has 10 criteria on which media reports about health are rated. For instance, do they mention the funding source? Do they report about harms and not only about benefits? Do they report in the same currency and so on? That's a great institution. They are struggling with getting funding. They have been partially closed down. For these important things that make people smart in a smart world, there's almost no funding. My personal story with the Harding Center is similar. Now the funding by David Harding is running out, and we are struggling to find any source. If we would produce a drug that already exists and just market it, that would be great. But funding that helps doctors and patients understand the evidence is still not running. Commercial conflicts of interest is very clear. We are suffering lots among them. And defensive medicine means that doctors do not advise you the best they believe what's for you, but something second or third best that protects them from you as a potential plaintiff being sued. That's the American system is most supportive for defensive medicine, and in every study where doctors are asked whether they perform defensive medicine, more than 90% of the doctors say yes, and I have no chance. I can't do the best medicine for my patients. So they do then unnecessary CTs, unnecessary MRTs, and anything is done, or antibiotics. And that's the problem, which is also not lost. Now, I'm spending the rest on the last issue, doctors' lack of understanding health statistics. That's probably the least known problem. You may rightly think that your doctor is trained to understand evidence. Have you ever checked it? Ask your doctor. So, I will talk about collective risk literacy. The term means that patients, doctors, journalists, politicians, and many others have never learned to understand evidence and can be easily tricked, like with the relative risk that you saw before. I'm going now to another famous concept. It's 5-year survival rates. Let's start with Rudy Giuliani. When he was running for president of the United States, Giuliani said, I had prostate cancer 5-6 years ago. My chances of surviving prostate cancer, and thank God I was cured of it in the US, 82%. My chances of surviving prostate cancer in England, only 44% under socialized medicine. That's what you got. And he proved, yeah, that American, yeah, commercialized medicine, pro-profit, is just better. It's free market. England, wake up. Give up your NHS. You might not like that, but 82 is more than 44, isn't it? Rudy Giuliani misled the public and probably himself. The fact is that differences in survival rates, say between the US and the UK, don't correlate at all with differences in mortality rates. And at that time, the mortality from prostate cancer was about the same in England as in the US. How can it be that mortality is basically the same, but 5-year survival rates are so different? Because 5-year survival rates don't tell you anything about mortality. That's the nice thing. And why is this? It's easy to understand. The first reason is lead time bias. So think about a group of men that has terminal prostate cancer, so they're all invasive prostate cancer, they all die at age 70. Half of this group doesn't go screening, the other half goes screening. So those who do not go screening, then prostate cancer is detected late, say age 67. They die at age 70. What is the 5-year survival rate? 0. Clear? The other group goes screening. Prostate cancer is detected at age 60. They die at age 70. What is the 5-year survival rate? 100%. Got it? The trick. Second reason, overdiagnosis. Again, two groups, the go screening, don't go screening. So the people, the men who do not go screening, so with progressive prostate cancer, 5 years later, 44% of them are alive. The others died. So the 5-year survival rate is 44%. Now, those who go screening, so it's not only that progressive cancers are detected, but many more non-progressive cancers. So this is, again, a cancer that you will never bother you in your life. You will die with the cancer, not from it. If you're a man and lucky to live into old age, it's almost certain that you have prostate cancer. It's a good news because that's the side effect, you got old. There are estimates that among 80-year-olds, 80% have prostate cancer, but only 3% die, okay? So, so here is the calculation, men with screening. Now these 2,000 in this example with non-progressive prostate cancer, they by definition don't die, but they enter the numerator and the denominator, and out comes Rudy Giuliani's number. See the trick? So the key to understand is that 5-year survival rates are measured from the beginning of the diagnosis. And in screening, the diagnosis is earlier. That's what you gain. Whether or not, you live longer. And now the question is, do physicians understand? Or would they fall prey to Rudy Giuliani's argument? We have done the first study with German physicians. So 65 statisticians have given them the actual data from one of the big randomized trials, but not mentioned prostate cancer, just cancer, so they have no prejudices. And then given them either differences in survival rates, like Rudy Giuliani did, and then 79%, judge screening as effective, although they don't tell you anything, the differences, yeah? And if there were mortality rates, only 5%. That means we can direct the opinion of doctors, of 75, of three quarters of doctors, in any direction about screening, depending on how we frame the success as survival or mortality rates. When we're asking about lead time bias, only 2 of 65 understood. You are already better than that. And overdiagnosis, none. Are American doctors better? We did the first study with now a representative sample of 412 primary care physicians, and basically the same result. When the information was provided in survival rates, just like Rudy Giuliani, then 83% judged the mortality benefit as large. Although they should say, it doesn't tell me anything. And when it was presented mortality rates, then many, many more or less. It's higher than the Germans because the Americans tend to do something and are also more under pressure of defensive medicine. We also asked whether screen-detected cancers have a better 5-year survival, whether that proves that cancer screening tests saves lives, and the same number, 3/4 thought yes. And mortality rates, the correct answers, about the same. 81% thought yes, and there are almost 20% who don't even know that. What surprised us most was the answers to the number two question, which proves that a cancer screening test saves lives. More cancers are detected in screening population. That doesn't prove anything, but almost half of the doctor thinks. And other studies since then have just replicated. If you just detect something, then you save lives. Oh, yeah. So the situation, as I see them, is that in this respect, not much has changed. Doctors are equally uninformed about understanding health statistics as 10 years ago. And I will later come to the reason of that. Let me first ask another question. Do politicians understand health statistics? And we already had Rudy Giuliani. Is he the only one? How about the UK? Here's another case. The UK Office of National Statistics noted that 5-year survival rates for colon cancer was 60% in the US compared to only 35% in Britain. Experts called this finding disgraceful and asked for a doubling of government spending. Now, in response, Tony Blair set the target to increase survival rates by 20% over the next 10 years, saying, we don't match other countries in that's colon cancer prevention, diagnosis, and treatment. He has been misled in the same way. And the target to increase survival rates by 20%. Through screening, you get it automatically without any benefit to patients. Theresa May, 20 years later, announced her cancer strategy and again fell prey to the survival rate story. She said, survival rates are increasing, but we are lagging behind other countries. Same thing, like the US. The US pushes everyone to screening so they get the big survival rates, but not better mortality rates. And then, 5-year survival rates for bowel cancer are over 90% if caught early, but less than 10% if diagnosed late, and so on. By 2028, 55,000 more people will be alive 5 years after their diagnosis. That's her goal, yeah? You just screen them. You get it automatically. What you need is better politicians. So, now, let's go into digital technology and big data analysis. I mentioned before that I'm not aware that there are many applications of big data analysis that actually help patients. But there are many stories, and much of funding goes in it, which we could use elsewhere. So you may remember that Microsoft engineers wanted to predict pancreas cancer. So imagine you are on Bing, on Microsoft website, and you are working on a brilliant text, and suddenly a window pops up which says, "Attention, you may have pancreas cancer. Visit immediately your doctor." How do you feel? Can you ignore that? No. You go to your doctor. No. I've written about that in the BMJ. How did they argue? They argued it could increase 5-year survival rates. Of course, it will increase 5-year survival rate, but it will not help. Because we have no cure for pancreas cancer. It's another distraction to real problems. And there were a number of other misleading screenings. The New York Times, by the way, reported naively that, quote, "The study suggests that early screening can increase the 5-year survival rate of patients with pancreatic cancer from 5 to 7, to 5 to 7 from just 3%. They also didn't get it. Journalists still have no training in understanding health statistics. And that's not the only case. So many other IT companies try to prove their relevance by moving into healthcare. So Google Flu has also used search terms to predict the flu. It all faltered. We have shown that Google Flu had 50 million search terms, and the complex algorithm is 160 selected search terms, and they tested hundreds of millions of models. And predicting the flu, so here is the short answer. AI works in a stable world. And here's where the successes are. Chess, Go, Jeopardy. But it has huge difficulties to deal with an unstable world that's dynamic, where things change. The flu changes all the time. People are unpredictable, what they do in this. In this world, complexity doesn't work. We have shown that if you use a single data point, you can predict the flu better than with big data. But that's another story. I'm not talking about my research on heuristics here. So, last questions. Do medical students learn to understand health statistics? And I will now show you one of the reasons for all of this mess is that thinking is not taught in medical school, with very few exceptions. And we have developed a test that tests 10 elementary concepts, just concepts. A test makes two errors, as it can overlook something, and the rate is a miss rate, or sensitivity, it's called. Or it can, sensitivity is now 1 minus miss. Or it can create a false alarm, and that's measured by the false alarm rate, or the specificity is 1 minus false alarm rate. Not very difficult. Or the concept of what is a relative risk, absolute risk. 10 questions like that. I'll show you a few of that. these are the first six. A test sensitivity is a central criterion for its quality as a diagnostic tool. The sensitivity is now four alternatives, and the student needs just to find the right one. Hmm? So the stars are not there in the test, they are for you. The sensitivity proportion of people with a positive test result among those who are sick. And it's not the proportion of people with a negative test result among those sick. Every medical student and doctor should know that. Otherwise, you cannot read any report about a new test, even digital test. The test specificity, same questions, same possible answers. And so it goes on, quite simple things to do. I show you now the results of the final year medical students at the Charité in Berlin. The Charité is one of Europe's light houses in medicine. And every student should get 100% on this test because these are so elementary questions. It's not about an interval. It's not about an odds ratio or anything like that. Here you see what you get. The red line is what you expect by chance. On average, the students get 50% correct. And you get already 25% by closing your eyes and just pointing. So what's the specificity? 20% don't know that. What's the, the sensitivity? What's the specificity? 30% don't know that at the end of the studies. What's the positive predictive value? 40% don't know that. What's the negative predictive value? Almost 50% don't know that, and so it goes on. What we have talked before are the relative risk versus absolute risk. So then it's only 20% who don't know even that. And the mortality rate versus survival rate, that's even below chance. And lead time bias and overdiagnosis. These students are not prepared to read and critically evaluate or even understand an article in their own field. Almost all of medicine is about statistics. And if that's exactly what's not being taught, then we are failing. And then we are not, don't have to be surprised why the doctors don't know that. Now here is now two hypotheses why this happens. One hypothesis is that students, after many years of medical training, they have unlearned thinking. The other one is, in these many years of medical training, they've never learned, never been taught that. Yeah? So we did, to test that, a short 90-minute test after this with the same students that included concepts and techniques that we developed to make this easier. And here's the result. Now they're on a level of 90%. So it's not that something is misfired. It's just simply that nobody teaches them. And here, this is another study I've done with professors of medicine. They should have more than 100%, right? They only have 75% on the SO. And finally, how can we help? And I'll be brief here. Fact boxes, and here's a fact box about whether influenza vaccination helps. Here's a fact box about ovarian cancer screening. These fact boxes are available on tablets, on smartphones with the AOK, that's the largest German health insurer. And at the end, here, is where we want to be. These are the 7 points we need to solve. And I hope that someone of you at some point can report we are there. So I was talking today about risk literacy. Many doctors, students, politicians, and journalists and patients still don't understand health statistics. We need to do something about that. And we also need clean information. Fact boxes, not misleading statistics. And at the end, the benefits of digitalization cannot be reaped if we don't solve the existing problems. Thank you for your attention.
The evidence is that the better the speaker, the more your mind is engaged. So I'd like you now to turn to your neighbor for 2 minutes and pick out some important things for you and for medicine and healthcare. Then we'll take some questions and comments. Okay, turn to your neighbor now, introduce yourself if you haven't met before, and okay, time to stop talking. Right, questions and or suggestions for action. Yes, just say, what are you, a medical student or a doctor or a statistician?
Yep. Hi, before we start, I'm going to use the microphone and just say, just to let you all know that you're being filmed and live webcast, so please bear that in mind when answering your question, and please wait for the microphone.
Sorry. Yes.
Thanks very much for the talk. I'm a mathematical modeler up at the Headington Medical Campus. I was curious about the understanding of five-year survival rates among doctors, and I was curious if you've looked at a control group of UK or US statisticians and seen what the understanding is in there as a suitable comparison.
I haven't studied UK statisticians. You can do that. I work very closely with David Spiegelhalter. And he surely understands it.
Yes, any more statisticians would like to be? Hands up if you're a statistician. We may come to you, Irene. Here we go. Yes?
Hi. I'm actually a medical science communicator, so I spend my time talking about this. I'm actually curious about something. Why do you think mortality rate is something that is so misunderstood, because it's not exactly very different, very difficult, and you keep having very low rates of understanding, yeah, at least in the graph.
So the one reason is that mortality rates are, in these examples I cited, not being reported, only survival rates. And the reason is because there is typically almost no difference in mortality rates, but then you always can report a difference in survival rates. And if you have the Microsoft application, you target survival rates, because here you will win. That's one of the reasons. The other reason is, of course, that the medical schools I know, they're not teaching these health statistics, and that's the most surprising thing. I have had conversations with heads of medical schools, including the last three CEOs of the Charité, and show them all this, what's happening on their own universities. If you think anything would have happened, no. The students at the Charité have now founded a work group on risk literacy. They want to learn it. Their professors are mostly disinterested.
People want to learn pipetting. I think that's the key thing, isn't it? Medical schools are focused on laboratories. Yeah.
Hi, I am a medical doctor, and I was wondering if you have data on the accuracy of clinicians for identifying how close the patient they are about to prescribe an intervention to is similar to the piece of evidence where that prescription comes from. To put an example, we know that thrombolysis for people who have an acute stroke, the more you deviate from the inclusion criteria of the study that prove a benefit, the more harm you do and the less benefits you get. And in the 10 concepts in the test you showed, I think it would be very interesting and very relevant to see how accurate doctors are to identify, is this patient like the ones in the study that prove the benefit I am trying to transmit or to integrate? Have you ever looked into that?
You make an important point, namely that doctors have to evaluate whether, even if they know the evidence base, whether the patient fits to that population being studied. Yes. The problem is that I pointed out that most doctors cannot even understand the evidence base. And that's the next question that would come. I don't have conducted and don't know specific studies to this process of evaluation, but it's an important point. It shows that evidence-based medicine, as I understand it, cannot be just knowing randomized trials. But you need a judgment whether this trial actually fits with the patients that you have. There are always something give you a base, what you know, but you still need clinical intuition, lots of experience, even gut feelings.
I'm also hoping some people will be saying a little bit what they're doing to tackle these problems, maybe Carl or others, but anyone in the audience doing things to try to make the world less bad? I'm always cautious about trying to make things better, but to make things less bad. Yep. Oh, sorry, you were first. Yes, yeah, please, Karen.
Hello, I'm, for the purposes of this, a patient. In the UK, there's a strong push towards patient participation in decisions. And I have seen quite a bit of conflict where the doctor is struggling to get their point across based on their knowledge versus, let's say the patient's been influenced by Dr. Google to a certain extent. I mean, how do you find the fact boxes help the doctors and the patients with those conversations?
My experience that fact boxes help both sides to get the evidence. The problem is that the ideal of informed consent cannot happen if patients and many doctors don't understand the evidence. It's a total illusion. Also, Muir's wonderful program of value-based requires that someone understands what the evidence is. Otherwise, you're not getting far. And the and on today in the many patients, probably most, look for information in the internet about health. And what you find, if you check on a certain issue, take screening. Screening is just a wonderful place for misleading information. I gave in California a talk to a large medical department and looked before what I get on the internet about, say, mammography screening. On the first page, this is where most people start and end. On the first page, there were maybe 10 or a dozen articles. All of them were misleading, with one exception. There was the Wikipedia entry in English, and we had edited it. All others were driven by other interests, getting women into screening, making money, defensive decision making, all things that do not help you as patient.
Partially cited leading the bride, they said. Well, of course, coming down the tracks is lung cancer screening, which is a major issue, which maybe in a year's time we'll be revisiting that as an example. Yes, you.
Hello, I'm a general practitioner and I'm currently working on a project to develop a website to give general practitioners better information on the benefits and harms of treatments. And in researching how to do that, I've been talking to GPs, and most of them have forgotten even very simple statistical terms, even if they had been taught it at medical school. Yeah. And where it looks like it's heading is that the way to communicate information to them will be in very, very plain language at a layperson level, and using simple graphic icon arrays to illustrate two in 100 people and five in 100 people. It seems to be the way that is appealing most to people, even the doctors.
Yes. The fact boxes that you can find on our website and other places, those who are showed have mostly numbers, but you can do them without numbers. In my experience, most doctors prefer fact boxes without numbers, and patients anyhow. So if you set up a website, go to our website and steal the fact boxes from ours. Just give a reference. Huh? Steal them and disseminate them. I think that's one of the most powerful tools that people can see the evidence and make their own judgment. What you still need to convey on a website is the message, have courage to take over responsibility for your own life and the life or the health of your children. And talk with doctors, of course, yeah. But keep in mind, if you're in the US, most doctors cannot advise you the best thing because it's defensive medicine. Or almost everyone, most doctors don't even know the evidence. Or there are conflicts of interest. So you need to take over the responsibility for your life. Convey that on your website. Just repeat it again and again and again and again. You are adult, huh? And nothing is certain in this world, huh? And if you take over the responsibility, at least you can blame yourself.
Should be able to take over responsibility, and that's what I have tried to do, but it's not easy. It's not easy to find the right evidence and to compare the relative risk with the absolute risks. And I would like to be able to rely on my doctor. You know, so from what you're saying tonight, I have felt that I haven't been able to rely on that, and now I feel even more that I probably can't. But I'm not sure where I understand what I'm looking for, and maybe the fact boxes I've not come across. But you know, you struggle as an individual to take that control.
Right.
Let me just make a comment on that, Gert, and then I'd like to ask Carol Hennigan, because when Carol and I, Carol's the director of the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine, but the people we talk about most are the ones you're seeing at the weekend, who are aged 92. It's not that they've got multi-morbidity, they've got multi-specialty problems. So they're maybe dealing with three specialties, all of them prescribing different things. And then if you try to look up the evidence, I mean, we haven't done this. It's quite heartening to me, the first editorial in the BMJ in 2020 was about multi-morbidity and saying, we have to think in a different way with an aging population. Carl, would you like to comment on the evidence for this really difficult group you see when you're on call at the weekend?
Yeah, thanks, Muir. Look, it's a real privilege to listen to Gerd, to follow his work for 20 years. We've had 25 years of evidence-based medicine at Oxford. Most people won't know in the room that the reason for that was that Muir made it happen when he brought Dave Sackett here to Oxford. And so we've been wrestling with lots of the issues, and some of the people you've had, like the Steve Wollishins up there and the Lisa Shorts, amazing work. And I think there are three points, really. I think the first is to say, you made it in the sort of funding. The people who do this work are people like yourself, David Spiegelhalter, amazing at what they do. But there's actually so few people who do this work. It is quite amazing in research institutes. And Muir said the pipetting, there's lots of that going on, but there's very few people working in a world to say, how do we apply evidence and communicate evidence at the coalface, if you like? And that's interesting, and that's a real problem. And that's probably a distortion of the incentives in research institutes. That's one. Two is, I think it's very difficult, and integration with clinical practice is really interesting. There are issues about the medical statistics, but if you look at the number of patients seen on a daily basis in the NHS, you know, we're talking about a million patients seen in a week in outpatients. The actual number of errors are quite small. So there are really interesting things going on within the consultation of when should you use the information and when can you, when can you rely on experience, expertise, other things like pattern recognition. So there's some really interesting issues in decision making. But I think, my third, and sorry I could stand here all day, but the lung cancer screening is a great example right now. We wrote about it last year. We're spending 70 million in the UK doing case finding as an experiment. Lung cancer Nelson trial came out a week ago and actually was incredibly similar to the breast cancer screening. In fact, there was a 24% reduction in lung cancer specific mortality. That translated into a 24% reduction in mortality, but actually the overall mortality is increased in Nelson. And it's really interesting. If you said you underwent screening and you would have a 10% increase in risk from death from other causes, you would go, oh my gosh. So we, and one thing here, I'm sorry to labour the point, is it comes down to a value judgment, doesn't it? The decision to do screening is a decision about whether you think it's a good thing or a bad thing. Our issue is, and what you're trying to do, which is incredibly interesting, is touch the surface of how do we better inform the public, but particularly policymakers, is a big issue right now, because before we know it, lung cancer screening is going to be rolled out, and it's going to cost us about £1 billion for no benefits. And that's where the problem lies.
Yeah. Let me start by the previous person who asked, how can I take over responsibility? Yeah. I think that's an essential thing. We all need to learn that. We all still are in a paternalist world. And it's not the other, the big daddy, it's us who want to be the child. And we need to learn in many other areas, like financial investment, take over responsibility, and have a minimum information about these things. And the tools are there, like fact boxes. And if you don't find a fact box, there's the Cochrane reviews. They are more difficult. But you in the UK have access to the Cochrane reviews. You're privileged. We in Germany don't. We've been fighting for a long time. The Americans also have no access for that. Yeah. So just think, well, I can't really give you advice, but look, in my position, I think I only live once. And when the day is where I die and I look back and said, you didn't dare, that would be the worst thing for me. Failing is good. On the question on that so few people do this work, correct. And one reason is also lack of funding. Steve Woloshin and Lisa Schwartz were struggling all the time. They had positions. They were full professors, but they had to find their own money for the salary. I mentioned Gary Schwitzer's Health News Review, a beautiful website. It's still up, but they're struggling on survival. And the same thing, I'm looking for, since years, for another David Harding, who was someone who sponsors the Harding Center. It is almost impossible. People give money to all cases, but not rarely ever to make people risk literate. And the lung cancer screening story is a typical story. I would go, so you never know everything, but a good guess is the following. We have no evidence that any kind of cancer screening saves lives. There are about 5 or 6 who reduce the cancer-specific mortality, like in mammography screening, and typically 1 out of 1,000, but one other person dies from another cause. So that's not saving lives. And I would say, given that, we shouldn't invest more, what was it, billion of pounds in finding a tiny significant difference that's irrelevant. But we should stop funding and investing the money where we can expect that it will save lives from cancer. And the story is very simple. Here's the argument. About 50% of cancers are at the end due to behavior. And it's, everyone knows, it's smoking, it's everything that contributes to obesity, too many alcohol. And this. Second, these behaviors like eating the wrong things are formed early in life, in childhood, mostly before puberty. Third, what follows, invest in making young people risk literate so that they understand what's being done once with them when they enter puberty, how they're being misled from industry to eat the wrong things, to get drunk, and how they're also dependent on their peers to get on the steps. If we only reach 20% in a program in schools that does that, in a playful way, not nudging, not forbidding, just make the little kids competent, tell them, that's how you will be manipulated. Then you get them emotionally. If you only get 20%, we will save more lives from cancer with, as the entire cancer screening programs, including probably the successes in medication. Why don't we invest in that? I can tell you an entire story where I spent 3 years with the Dutch Cancer Society, and we had all planned, and the Cancer Society was willing to invest money. At the end, he gave the money to big data analytics. And they're still searching for the cause of cancer, and whoever got it, IBM or Siemens or so, they make their business. That's the problem. Yeah? We need to turn around and invest where we actually can do something good for patients and save lives.
Well, we may have to take a different approach. When Dave Sackett came, I told him two things. I didn't want him wasting his time inside the Oxford Ring Road, apart from seeing patients, because he was come to do something else. And secondly, I said Martin Luther should be his role model. To preach for conversion. And it may be we do need to think of a different approach. If we think of, I mean, the brain power of Gert, Carl Hennig, and others in this room, but this is much more emotional. And I'm just wondering whether we shouldn't rebrand what we're doing. And one thing that's emerged, I think, has been, I mean, the word patient. Why don't we set up a campaign for death to the patient? Let's get rid of the word patient. In a legal point of view, the person we call the patient is the principal and the clinician is the agent. So the word patient may be part of the problem that we've got. I think we need to be thinking now about a different approach, and with a good Protestant city like Berlin and Luther and Oxford, where we're very good at religion and talking about things, I think we're not succeeding in our rational approach. Now, Carl's very good at getting on television shows that the academics perhaps would not approve of, but we have to, I think, think of a new way. We need a new movement, and that movement is about the citizen, the principal, the person. And it is much more, this is the most complex business on earth. And what we've heard tonight has been someone making the most complex decisions that you ever face in your life about whether to have this treatment or that treatment or no treatment, clearly. And we just need to think how we spread that word. Gert, you've been an inspiration to us, and I'm glad you're working full blast. And I told you, Gert, that in addition to doing away with the word retirement, I've done away with the word patient, we've done away with the word retirement. So Gert's in his renaissance. And I think we need to think now about how we take this forward. Gert, you're an inspiration to us. Thank you very much.